Welcome to another Sailing Doodles podcast. My guest today is very well known, Rick Doblin. So, and you are the, I'm gonna butcher that. I've tried to say this so many times. The Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies.
For psychedelic studies.
Yeah.
Okay.
The MAPS.
MAPS. Also known as MAPS.
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you so much for meeting with me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And so. So for those that don't know, what is MAPS?
MAPS is a nonprofit organization that I started in 1986, and it was basically a psychedelic pharmaceutical company designed to try to take MDMA and potentially other psychedelics through the FDA to make them into prescription medicines. And I started MAPS 1 year after the Drug Enforcement Administration criminalized MDMA.
Right.
In 85, and they were really trying to criminalize ecstasy, the party drug.
Right.
They didn't know anything about it being a therapy drug. The therapeutic community was kind of collateral damage in this prohibition mindset.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's a common thing with the government anyways. They kind of just jump to conclusions. They don't think about the long-term consequences of banning, like, because what do they call it? It's a class...
Wow.
It's a Schedule 1, which just means... What, no medical benefit and high incidence of abuse, right?
Yes. And it's more difficult to try to bring Schedule 1 drugs into research. There's more controls.
Right.
DEA, and it's like heroin, for example.
Right.
Even cannabis is in Schedule 1.
Right.
So what the FDA and the DEA have been doing is whenever drugs are taken out of Schedule 1, like THC, oral THC has been approved as a medicine for... nausea control, for cancer chemotherapy, also for appetite stimulation.
Is that federally or
AIDS federally?
Oh, wow.
But they'll move the medical product out of Schedule 1.
Okay.
And they'll keep the rest of it, recreational use, the non-medical, still in Schedule 1.
Okay.
So that's they call it bifurcated scheduling.
Right.
Yeah.
That kind of doesn't really make sense. I mean, I get what they're doing, but it...
Well, they want to keep the penalties up for the non-medical. That's why they do it.
Okay. So we can kind of get into the legal stuff and, like, the advances you've helped do. But, like, first, like, what are some of the benefits of that kind of therapy with, like, MDMA and all that?
Well, the first thing, let me make a distinction. Maybe people may have heard about ketamine or Spravato being made into a medicine for depression.
Right.
But it's made into a medicine where the... experience of the drug is the medicine itself, meaning that you can do it and you can take it at home, or in some ways you have to do it under, people have been doing it under Zoom supervision or different ways. So with MDMA assisted therapy, really it's about the therapy,
right?
And then the MDMA makes the therapy more effective.
And is it make it more effective? I mean, because it in my experience, it makes you more empathetic and understanding and honest. I mean, you can express your concerns and thoughts and everything a little better than you ordinarily could.
It does that, yes. It also, by this, I think this ability to be more honest, as you say, that means you're less defensive.
Yes.
You're less self-critical. You're more filled with self-acceptance.
Right.
And so when we work with people who are traumatized, so with the research that I chose to do, this idea of what would make it into a medicine first, what psychedelic would make it into a medicine first, I think it was MDMA, the most gentle of all the psychedelics, the easiest to integrate, the less ego dissolving. And then PTSD being a disorder that has sympathetic patients. That is the key thing. So women are mostly the ones that suffer from PTSD. From sexual assault and domestic violence and childhood events and all of that. But it's the male veterans that get most of the media attention.
Right.
And that's what's enabled us to get bipartisan support. So the idea is that the therapy, the current therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder, prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, they're difficult for people because you're asked to address your trauma, which has been very overwhelming for people. And we only work with chronic PTSD, too, not these people that have been recently traumatized. And so in the study that the Veterans Administration just put out recently, 916 veterans, half the people dropped out of the study because they couldn't handle talking about their trauma.
You're talking about they were doing a study without...
Without any MDMA.
Right,
yeah, just these non-drug psychotherapies, prolonged exposure and cognitive processing. But what the MDMA does is it reduces this sense of fear of difficult emotions,
right,
and fear of traumatic memories,
yes,
so that you can approach them in a more manageable way, and then you can let out the feelings, your emotions are more open.
Well, I think just being able to, like, talk about stuff like that. I mean, just being able to accept it with your own self and, like, be able to say those things that you're holding in or something like that, or these emotions that you can't express any other way, that's helpful in its own. So the treatment, it's not, you're not, it is, it, how long is the treatment process? Okay. I mean, you're not just giving them MDMA and be like, here we go. It's long.
Yeah. Well, it's a 3.5 month treatment.
Okay.
But within this, you only get MDMA 3 times.
Right.
So it's not like a daily medication. It's different from SSRIs and traditional drugs that you get from psychiatrists and the pharmaceutical industry that are drugs that are meant to be taken on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And they reduce the symptoms. They reduce the highs. They reduce the lows. They have sexual side effects, all sorts of problems. But they do help some people who are feeling overwhelmed.
Right.
But it's mostly symptom control and doesn't deal with the core issues. And then when you stop taking the drugs, your problems come back.
And they're habit forming, and they can lead to some serious physical side effects.
And it's difficult to do withdrawal from them either. The tapering is complicated. So our approach with the MDMA is completely different. It's like, let's get to the root cause of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Let's help you process it, meaning experience and express the emotions. And then let's do that in a way where the goal is to make it so that at the end of the treatment, you don't need the MDMA anymore.
Right.
So it's 3.5 months, 3 MDMA days, and those are 8 hours long.
Wow, 8 hours.
So it's 8-hour therapy sessions.
Okay.
It's with 2 therapists.
Okay.
Usually a man and a woman, but not always. And then there's 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions as well. So you have 3 90-minutes, more or less, once a week.
Right.
Before the first MDMA session for preparation. And then you have 3 of these 90-minute sessions between the first and the second MDMA session to integrate the first, and then 3 to integrate the second, and then 3rd to sort of integrate. And what I mean by integrate is to learn the lessons, to talk about what happened, to try to be similarly open to those kind of memories and experiences, you know, even after the drug is worn off. Because what we're trying to do is help people learn how to heal themselves.
Right.
So that then when life presents them with other traumas, that they're not overwhelmed and they've learned this process, that it's better to be open and let it run through you than try to suppress it. And the MDMA gives people this ability to feel they can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 42 hours of therapy.
Right.
With 2 people. So it's very labor intensive.
Sure.
And that's why we say it's about creating a safe context. And the research that's been done in psychotherapy outcome research shows that the most important factor is the relationship between the therapist and the patient, called the therapeutic alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more important than the school of therapy that's practiced.
Right. Because you need to be able to trust that person and be comfortable expressing all. I mean, I'm sure the MDMA helps or whatever, but just being able to be comfortable with that person
So to give you an example, in our first phase 3 study, we work with the hardest cases. You know, psychedelics have been stigmatized, and we need to work with sympathetic patients with the hardest cases.
Mm-hmm.
So our first phase 3 study had people that had PTSD in an average of 14 years.
Oh, wow.
But 1/3 was over 20 years.
Wow.
The veterans sort of were more recent. They moved the average down.
Mm-hmm.
We work with almost 1/3 of the people had what's called positive behavior, meaning that they tried to kill themselves, or they went to a store and bought a rope and then decided not to hang themselves, or went to a bridge and thought about jumping off but didn't. Mm-hmm. So we do enroll people in previous attempts at suicide.
Right.
We have people high on what's called the dissociative subtype, because that's a common and somewhat successful strategy when you're being traumatized to sort of dissociate. You're like, you're not really there. But then it makes it harder to do the healing because you have to get back into.
Right.
So we worked with the hardest cases. And what we showed is that with the therapy without MDMA, the control group was therapy without MDMA compared to therapy with MDMA.
Right.
And around 1/3 of the people no longer had PTSD 2 months after the last experimental session.
After they've been 14 to 20 years having PTSD.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, this is 1/3 without MDMA, just with the therapy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So the therapy, you know, you sort of thought, you know, 8 hours is kind of an unusual therapy session.
Sure.
But when you think about it, a one-hour therapy session, you got to get in, you got to relax, you open up a little bit, you start telling you what's happening.
And then it's over.
And then you got to close up again because you got to go out and be in public and start the rest of your day. So, and then you get focused more just on your trauma, what's the big issues. Mm-hmm. When you have an eight-hour therapy session, around we have people wear blindfolds. Whenever they can take it off whenever they want, and headsets. And so there's music that's piped into the room so the therapists know the music. And we believe in this hypothesis of this inner healing intelligence. Mm-hmm. And what we mean by that is that we know that we hurt our body and it heals itself, restores order below the level of our conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought is that the mind is something like that, you know, that you have to clear out the obstacles. If you've got, you know, stones and stuff and dirt in a wound, you got to clean it out. So the cleaning it out, in our sense, is this processing the emotions. And this inner healing intelligence belief means that whatever emerges, we support the emergence of it.
Right.
So it could be the trauma. People often go to happy memories.
Mm.
In a way, they're building strength to go to the trauma.
Sure.
And people have, we call it the archaeology of trauma. They have layers and layers of trauma. You're not, in the traditional therapies, you focus on the worst trauma and go over and over. But people have sequences of them also throughout their life. So people have the freedom in this 8 hours to be inner focused whenever they want. There's no need for the therapist to track actually what's going on with the patient. What the therapists are supposed to be tracking is the patient open to it or closed? Are they resisting, in which case they might need emotional support, or are they open to it, whatever it is? And we check in once an hour if we don't hear from people. And then you hear these incredible stories about what they've been doing. So around half the time is talking to the therapist. The other half the time is having their own inner experience.
Right.
And it's very poetic and metaphorical. People are retelling their story of their lives to themselves in different ways. You know, one of the examples was a veteran who came back from Iraq, and he had rage, and he would throw stuff at his wife. He never hit his wife, and never, but he would make her cry all the time, and this was rage. Mm-hmm. This is his big issue. In his first MDMA experience, he started talking about how he had this warrior self that he learned not to trust in Iraq because he saw what it could do.
Right.
And now he's home, and he had it locked in a cage inside him.
Right.
And it had, this like gorilla had reached through the cage of the bars and stabbed him in the side.
Yeah.
And so during the MDMA experience, when his eyes are closed, he's going through this whole thing about how he's realizing that this is a part of him.
Right.
That it's only made worse by trying to lock it up. Mm-hmm. That he reaches out, pulls the knife out of his side. He opens the door. He braces him. He said it was like a friend trying to catch up.
Right.
And from that point on, he was no longer rageful.
Wow.
He still had lots of work to do on his traumas,
of course,
his friends that have been killed and all of that had happened. He'd almost been killed. But there's a way in which people make this gradual progress. There's another story. I'll just say this woman who had tried everything to get better. She had terrible PTSD, and she had tried therapy and different drugs, and none of it worked. And she volunteered for the MDMA, and she said that if it didn't work, she was going to go to Nepal and commit suicide.
Wow.
So it's pretty heavy if you're
Hey,
if this doesn't work, this person's going to kill himself. So in the first MDMA session, the first of three, again, about an hour and a half, she turned to the therapist and she said, "I don't think I'm going to have to go to Nepal anymore."
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. But this was even before she processed a lot of her trauma. But
right.
The shift in the way MDMA helps you process your emotions and helps you reflect on traumatic things in the past was enough different that it gave her a sense of hope that she could work through. These were a tool that she could work through.
Right.
And so I think this reduction of fear, we talk about it in terms of the reduction of activity in the amygdala, which is the fear processing part of our brain. There's less activity there. There's more activity in the prefrontal cortex where we are thinking logically. If you have PTSD, you have less activity in the frontal cortex.
Okay.
You're triggered.
You're reactionary.
You hear a noise. You don't have time to sort out. Is that a weapon? Is that a bomb? Is that a car backfire? What is that?
Yeah.
And then also the other big part of having PTSD is that the traumas are never in the past. They're always...
You're reliving it.
Reliving it. Yeah. They're about to happen again. It colors everything you see. Mm. And so there's a part of the brain, the hippocampus, where memories are put into long-term storage.
Right.
And there's less activity there if you've got PTSD. And with MDMA, it increases activity in the hippocampus and connectivity with the amygdala. So it's almost like you've got traumatic memories stuck in short-term memory.
Right. Okay.
And you have to process them and move them into the past. And then they become part of your story. It sort of moves from foreground to background.
Right.
And we even have a measure that we use called post-traumatic growth inventory. So when things go really well, people can learn from the trauma. You know, learn what's a danger that they didn't think was a danger, or just makes them think, this trauma almost killed me or whatever. Now, what do I want to do with my life?
Right.
You know, am I doing what I think is most important? So that's this post-traumatic growth inventory. So I think it acts in a way in which people who've never done psychedelics before, a lot of the people in our studies have never done psychedelics before. I'd say it's more gentle than marijuana. Because when you smoke good marijuana, or even any marijuana, you get this flood of, you know, flow of ideas.
Right.
You're not thinking. It's not as logical anymore.
Right.
You're bringing in emotional. Your connections to your thoughts are wider, more creative spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, but there is this loss of control in a way when,
right.
when you're really high. With
yeah. It gives you anxiety sometimes.
Very,
you can't.
Yeah, very much. And so MDMA is easier.
Right.
Because it reduces that fear and anxiety, mm-hmm. and you don't think, there's not this flow of you're losing sense of who you are. Like when people think about LSD or psilocybin, and you know that does move to ego dissolution
right.
in a way, and you
it's
blend with something bigger, you know, and that can be, we're so identified with our story and our life that when that egocentric part of our brain is less active, people often confuse that with actually die.
Right.
That you think this loss of sense of self is physical death. And so people freak out.
Yeah. Sometimes. That's what they
think. But that doesn't happen with MDMA.
Right. You said, I mean, just through the basic therapy, I mean, people were like a third better. I mean, so when you added the MDMA, what was the results on that?
Two-thirds better.
Two-thirds better.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Okay. Now, not only that, but there's another measure, which is called clinically significant reductions of PTSD.
Okay.
So you can have severe PTSD and you can get a lot of help. You can still have enough symptoms of PTSD, but your life is not as debilitated.
Right.
So that's called a responder. So we had another 21% that were responders. So we had 88%, two-thirds no longer had PTSD, another 21% life was changed.
That's pretty significant.
Better. And 12% were non-responders.
So where are you on the studies now? I mean, like, with Schedule I drug, and how do you get this approved? Like, where are you in that process?
Yeah. So let me start. From 1986, when I started MAPS, we had five different protocols all rejected by the FDA. 1992, they permitted us to do the first Phase 1 dose-response safety study with MDMA. That took us through the 90s. And then in 2000, we started working with PTSD.
Okay.
And that took till 2016, this whole series of pilot studies.
Wow.
Well, we had to raise the money through philanthropy.
Okay.
And so we were doing things in sequence and not in parallel. There was also a lot of political resistance.
Sure.
At all these different levels. 2016, we were permitted to go to what's called Phase 3, which is the final stage. You need two randomized placebo-controlled double-blind studies in order to prove safety and efficacy. So we started those in 2018, and we finished the second one in September 2023.
Okay.
And so December 11th of 2023, we submitted all the information to the FDA in what's called a new drug application. And the FDA has 2 months to review it to see, is all the information there? Are we going to be able to really evaluate, is it safe and is it efficacious? So February 9th, the FDA said yes.
Oh, wow.
They accept the filing.
Okay.
Then because it was been considered a breakthrough therapy, a significant advance on currently available treatments, the FDA granted what's called priority review, which means that they take 6 months. So we are now going to be hearing from FDA before August 11th. 2024, about whether MDMA is accepted as a medicine with therapy by prescription.
Wow. How available, I mean, I can't imagine they would say no. I mean, knock on wood, right? But
well, I don't think they're going to say no.
Okay.
Because we also, as I said, November 29th, 2016, we had the end of phase two meeting. But then I didn't go to phase two, to phase three. We engaged what's called special protocol assessment process, where you try to negotiate every aspect of your design, your statistical analysis plan, all the safety information that we're going to see. And we did get an agreement letter.
Okay.
So the agreement letter means that the FDA must approve the drug if we get statistical significance, if there's no new safety problems, and if we survive FDA audits to show that we gathered the data properly.
Correctly, yeah.
We've just had a bunch of these audits. We have excellent safety data and excellent statistical significance. So we do think that there's more than a 90% chance that FDA will say yes. Now, once FDA, if they do say yes, August 11th, or before, that's not enough for patients to get to it because
right.
it's in Schedule 1.
Right.
So what needs to happen is the Drug Enforcement Administration has 90 days to reschedule, to decide where it goes, Schedule 1, Schedule 2. It has to go out of Schedule 1,
right.
FDA says, but Schedule 2, 3, 4, or 5. 5 is like over the counter. It's not going to do that.
But that's just for your specific application of it, not MDMA in general.
MDMA in general, as I said, is going to stay in Schedule 1.
Right, okay.
As a bill, but our encapsulated product
right.
will move.
Right.
So there's 90 days for the DEA to do that. Then that's not enough because the states all independently schedule. So half the states in the country automatically reschedule when they follow the FDA and DEA. The other half, we have to go to the Board of Pharmacy. We have to do
right.
different kind of things. So we think that by early 2025,
right.
that this will be available by prescription, MDMA-assisted therapy. And we did phase three purposely in Israel, Canada, and the United States. And so the FDA, and you submit the protocols, the foreign protocols also to FDA before we start. So we think that FDA will indeed, first off, make it into a medicine. And then there's a lot of people willing to go second, but not a lot of people willing to go first.
Right.
As Andrew, in general, for all yeah. sorts of things.
Sure.
So both Health Canada, the Ministry of Health, and Israel are looking for the FDA to go first.
Yeah.
But once they say yes, then it's a short time after for Canada and Israel. Australia has already approved the compassionate use of MDMA and psilocybin.
Really? Wow.
So Australia will be next. We're doing some work in Brazil, also in England. You know, England had Brexit, and now they're independent of the European Medicines Agency. They make their own decisions, so they want to show that they've got something from Brexit. So they were the first country to approve vaccines.
Okay.
So they may be, they definitely will be before European Medicines Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's a, we're a victim of our own success. And so what I mean by that is that MAPS raised about $150 million in donations over our history. And we cleared out all these regulatory obstacles at FDA, and we demonstrated that even in these controlled circumstances, you can get excellent results. And what that led to was the rise of for-profit psychedelic companies. And now there are hundreds of for-profit psychedelic companies, which made it more difficult for us to raise donations.
Right. Because
all these people are like, why should I donate? Look at all these people trying to make money. And so we ended up having to take investors.
Okay.
And so now there's a split between Lykos Therapeutics, which is the name of the pharma company, of which MAPS is the largest shareholder, but we're a minority shareholder. And that is the organization that submitted this new drug application to the FDA, and they're eventually hoping to become a public company and to
right.
become a big pharma company. And so now that we have to balance public benefit with return to shareholders, they will go to where there's lots of trauma, but where people can pay, either insurance companies. And MAPS, the nonprofit, is going to go to where there's lots of trauma, but people can't pay,
right?
Meaning humanitarian projects around the world.
So my first question, we'll come circle back to that in just a second. My first question is, okay, so say it does get approved, everything. It's still got to be a pretty long pipeline to work, because you have to train all the...
The therapist.
Therapist, thank you. And then to get to that point where, like, it can be available to your average person.
Okay, so you raised a really important point. So that there's 13 million PTSD patients in America. MDMA-assisted therapy is not good just for PTSD.
Right.
You know, 90% of the people in our study also have depression.
Okay.
We've never tested people with depression without PTSD,
right.
But we've worked with people that are anxious or depressed because they have life-threatening illnesses. Mm-hmm. We've done studies that were with autistic adults with social anxiety. It helps people be more social, and even autistic adults have been able to function better with people after MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
There's anecdotal reports about MDMA for postpartum depression, for eating disorders. It was a study in England for alcohol use disorder with MDMA. It turns out people are running away from trauma into alcohol. You help them process the trauma.
Sure.
So there's going to be this globalization effort on the part of the nonprofit, while the for-profit tries to, I think, Israel, Canada, U.S., England, Brazil, and then Europe. And then MAPS will go, more humanitarian projects and Central America, South America, Ukraine. We're trying to do a lot of work in Ukraine.
I'm sure, yeah, there's a need for that now, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have much, because, the pharmaceutical industry is fairly cutthroat. I mean, so do you have some of the, I don't know who makes, Ambien or Xanax and all that. I mean, are they scared of, the SSRIs and all that? I mean, are they scared that you're going to take part of their market and try to prevent you from getting approved?
Well, first off, the FDA is designed to insulate itself from pressures from pharmaceutical companies and trying to block competitors' products.
Sure.
So if the FDA was vulnerable to that, all the pharma companies would be putting loads of resources into that.
Right.
So basically, it's very difficult for a pharma company to try to block the FDA from approving a potential competitor's drug.
Right.
The other big point is that the innovation in psychiatry has slowed very much over the last 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the SSRIs and a lot of the big money makers have gone generic.
Right. Okay.
So that there's not this, I do not feel at this point pharmaceutical companies trying to block what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, pharmaceutical companies have supported the war on drugs.
Right.
To try to criminalize cannabis and mm-hmm. keep it, and criminalize psychedelics and criminalize all sorts of things, and that would be like the moat. We're going to criminalize all these things.
Sure.
And they also thought, how are anybody, small nonprofits, how are they going to make it through the FDA system?
Right.
They'll tell you it takes billions of dollars.
Exactly.
But it doesn't. It's not actually true. So, in some sense, is it true? So when you hear from a pharmaceutical company, it costs billions of dollars. Part of that is a story to justify high prices.
Right.
But the other part is that they're businesses, so there's opportunity cost.
Right.
So what that means is when you put money into developing a drug, you could have put it into the stock market, you could put it into whatever. So of these billions of dollars that they say, that pharma companies say they have to spend to make a drug into a medicine, around half of it is opportunity cost.
Right.
It's not.
You're saying I could have made 7% over the last 5 years instead of just throwing that money in. Then so now I need to make 35% to make up for that last 5 years.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. Then the other part is they amortize all of their failures into their few successes.
Because then not everything's a success.
Most things are not a success.
Okay.
So then you're paying for all the failures also.
Right.
And then the other part, and I'm not sure how many of sailors will know about Aikido, the martial art of Aikido.
Yep.
So the idea is that you kind of use the momentum of your opponent, kind of you step out of the way and you kind of help them sort of reap the damage, if they're trying to go after you.
You're redirecting their momentum and putting it on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
So where I'm saying that helps us is in the safety studies. So pharmaceutical companies have to spend loads of money on the safety of their drug. It's never been existed before. They've synthesized some new thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, the Aikido strategy is to work with highly demonized drugs like ecstasy
mm-hmm.
that governments around the world have spent $400 or $500 million over the years. What's bad with them?
Right.
All this stuff about MDMA neurotoxicity or holes in your brain, people have probably heard, or some of the more outrageous ones about draining your spinal
fluid. Yeah,
So there are over 5,000 papers in PubMed, which is the list of scientific papers in medical journals, over 5,000 on MDMA or ecstasy. So we've spent $1 million to review all them, read all them, summarize all them, and now we have an enormous safety database that we didn't have to pay for.
Yeah.
All right, so we've been able to make MDMA into a medicine for somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 million. Now, we're raising more to build a commercialization company, because once you make it into a medicine, you still got to get it to the patient.
Right.
But so it's not the case. Yeah, they necessarily cost billions of dollars.
So I imagine, I mean, the drug itself probably, I mean, to manufacture it won't be the expensive part. It'll be the training of the therapist and that, because you're talking, you said 80 hours of therapy over.
Well, 42 hours for two people. So right, it's 84.
84.
Yes.
So that's the expensive part, right, I imagine.
Yes. Now, one of the things we're trying to look at is group therapy.
Oh, okay.
All right. So at the Portland, Oregon Veterans Administration, the first group therapy study has just started with MDMA. So it's going to be four therapists with six veterans with PTSD. Mm-hmm. They're each going to get two MDMA sessions. Mm-hmm. The first is going to be an individual session where they understand MDMA, what it does. They work on their own individual traumas.
Right.
Then they do a group session. So in Israel, we've raised about $1.85 million now to do 400 people. We're trying to raise still another couple hundred thousand dollars, but 400 people to go through group therapy, people traumatized together. But it will start with two therapists, two assistants, so not necessarily four therapists,
right?
And six people with PTSD.
Right.
They'll both get they'll all get two MDMA experiences, but both will be in groups. So when we think about global humanitarian projects, like just think there's a million Ukrainian refugees in Poland. There's millions of Ukrainians have left the country. When that happens, you've got people traumatized in family groups. And one of the things that's also the case is that in America, we have loads of therapists and psychiatrists, but many countries don't have that many, or any hardly.
Right.
Like in Rwanda, like in Somaliland, like in South Africa, like in Lebanon, all the other places, they don't have a lot of therapists. So we're going to have to be experimenting with group therapy,
right,
with local healers, and also treating families together.
Right.
And I should, it may sound strange to people, but I'll add that the FDA has said that if on August 11th or before they approve MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, it would be for 18 years or older, no upper age limit.
Okay.
Then we are being required to study adolescents.
Really?
We must study adolescents, and we have to go down pretty much to age 7 to treat traumatized kids. And we think nothing of giving Adderall or Ritalin to kids for ADHD.
I guess
methamphetamine.
Yeah.
Let's just give methamphetamine.
That's what it is, technically, yeah.
So, and that's on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So we're talking about traumatized children, giving them a few experiences with MDMA in a therapeutic setting.
Right.
And
but yeah, we were talking traumatized. So okay.
It's not just we're giving the
right. Yeah. I get that. But I mean, there's a lot of 7-year-olds that have had some pretty serious trauma.
Very much.
So yeah, I can see how that would, because then that trauma can basically ruin them for the rest of their life. And so if you can address that early enough to where they realize it's not their fault, it's, you know, or whatever, that they can understand and get on and move on and have a relatively normal life.
Yeah, well, just that, think out that if you are traumatized at a young age, you're suspicious of people, you don't trust people, it's as you mature and as you start hanging with friends, it influences everything else after that.
All right.
So I'm very much looking forward to that idea. And from an insurance company point of view, just to say that they look at what they call QALYs, quality adjusted life years. If you save somebody from cancer and it gives them 10 more years, you know, how much is that worth?
Well, sure. I mean, you do 1 3-month, treatment with MDMA versus being on SSRIs for 25 years.
Right.
It's going to be a lot cheaper doing that, or doing the treatment.
Yeah, and never reach the same place even with SSRIs. You can reach a much deeper place. So I think when you talk about adolescence, this idea is that it makes even more sense for the insurance companies, because you're changing their life for more years.
Right, yeah. So what? Another thing. I imagine it's in the it's probably something planned for the future. But I mean, I would think like couples therapy.
Okay, great. So the nonprofit is now in the process of developing a couples therapy protocol.
Right.
Couples therapy is not a disease.
Right.
Depression, anxiety.
Oh, right.
So it's not clear that the FDA would ever approve it. However.
Right.
We've had some senior people at the FDA saying there is nothing in the law that prevents them from approving couples therapy. So MAPS is going to start with a protocol for couples therapy as an academic study.
Right.
The challenge is going to be, how do you determine success?
Right.
So many couples are well matched. They have problems. They'd like to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
But you got a bunch of other couples that probably would be better off separating.
Yeah.
And so the metric of success is going to be more about mutuality of decisions or about quality of communication.
Right.
But it won't be, do they stay together or not?
Right, yeah.
And then there's other different ideas. We could work with people that have decided to get divorced and are in mediation. And maybe we could help the mediation go smoother. But rather, we think we're going to start on the earlier side when people are hoping to still stay together,
right.
But they're starting to talk to couples therapists. And then,
yeah. Well, I mean, when we first started talking about it, I mean, like, you know, it just increases your empathy and your honesty and your willingness to communicate and all that. And I think, I mean, you're talking about relationships. That's probably the top three things you need in a relationship.
Yeah.
And so I could see how that would greatly benefit, just because I think a lot of people that end up splitting up, it's not that they can't get along. It's just that they don't vocalize what's the problem. And
yeah.
So if you could actually say, hey, this is my problem, and instead of, if I say, hey, this is my problem with you, if you have MDMA, this thing, I'm not going to take offense by that. I'm going to say, oh, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And so we can talk about it and get it out there.
Exactly. So there's a measure we call self-compassion.
Mm.
So MDMA does enhance self-compassion. It means that you have compassion for yourself, all your flaws, your mistakes, so that you're not as vulnerable and you're more empathic, so that you can hear people's critiques of you in a deeper way,
right?
Less defensively. Also, conflict resolution.
Mm.
So there are small groups of Israelis and Palestinians doing ayahuasca and MDMA together, and Lior Roseman is a neuroscientist at Exeter in Canada. He's done work with bringing groups of Israelis and Palestinians to Spain for ayahuasca.
Yeah, wow.
And then we're working on a protocol to develop that for MDMA.
Wow.
The metrics are the key thing.
Sure.
But we like to joke that once we've helped these Israelis and Palestinians, then we're going to do the harder case on Democrats and Republicans.
I was just about to say, how about we make it a requirement for the president to go and undergo it? And when you become president, you have to go through a session on MAPS.
Well, I think that it always should be voluntary.
Well, yes.
But I hear that. And I do think that if you're not open to it,
yeah.
You can resist it. You have to
sure.
be willing. But I do think that there is a lot to be said for politicians and people to really have these experiences. Because even as individuals or politicians, you see the world through this lens of trauma.
Mm.
It's like a dirty windshield.
Right.
And everything looks dirty and suspicious and untrustworthy. And if you can process your own trauma, then you can kind of separate out. Those people were the ones that hurt me. And these people are not necessarily about to do that. I need to be careful, but I need to be hopeful as well as fearful. So I think there was a story in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists that you could maybe reference to in this. It just came out a couple of years ago. It was during the 80s. And a friend of mine was working with some of the scientists from the U.S. and Russia that were part of the arms race.
Huh.
And so during the Reagan-Gorbachev arms control meetings, there was meetings at Esalen. It was called the Soviet-American Exchange Program. It was called Track 2 Diplomacy.
Okay.
So when the governments aren't talking so well, you get different people to talk. And so some of those were the rocket scientists on both sides. So we ended up sending a bunch of MDMA to Russia.
Okay.
For all these people. And so we didn't talk about it, but it's so far past.
Yeah, that, sure.
I did briefly mention something of that. It's somebody from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which keeps the doomsday clock.
They're the guys, yeah.
So they just published an interesting article.
Okay.
And I think, I'll just share, we were talking about it just a moment ago, that the Reagan-Gorbachev arms control meetings, I noticed that they were scheduled always on the full moon.
Really?
Yeah, and what that meant is, you know, and these people were negotiating, and they're negotiating deep into the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be under a full moon is kind of like, yeah, it's a bigger system. We're all in this global thing. We need to think more globally.
Yeah.
So it turned out that it was Nancy Reagan's astrologer
Oh, really?
It set the dates for the Reagan-Gorbachev arms
diplomacy. Okay.
All right, so I think that the full moon had some sort of an impact.
All right.
And I think that the MDMA that we sent to
okay,
had
maybe did some sort of an impact.
Of course, they still had to negotiate and work it all out. Psychedelics can play a role well when they're used in an appropriate context,
sure.
when they're supportive. At the same time, and this is now, there's 13 million PTSD patients in America, just 350 million plus in the world. How are we going to train enough therapists?
Right.
So,
the hard part.
So that MAPS has got this, as a nonprofit, it's got this parallel track. One is the drug development through the FDA. The other is drug policy reform.
Right.
So we think prohibition is counterproductive.
I agree.
And these things should be available in pure form so people know what they're getting.
Right.
Young people have recently died from getting fentanyl contaminated
right.
ecstasy.
Right.
That's from the drug war. That's not from the drug.
And then there's 35,000 murders in Mexico every year because of it. And then how many other murders and all that?
Right.
Exactly. Yes, if it was just legal and
regulated,
taxed, there'd be a lot less deaths from it.
Well,
I mean, there'd be some collateral damage. Sure.
There will be. So I just gave a talk the other day to 60 police officers. It was incredible because there's a police officer, Sarko Gagarin, who's also a therapist. And he's been through our training to learn to be a therapist to administer MDMA. More police officers die by suicide than die in the line of duty.
Oh, really?
More veterans die by suicide than die in the line of duty.
Yeah, so, that's pretty.
So this talk to the police officers was that this is for them. The police have a very difficult job, very traumatic,
mm-hmm.
high incidence of alcoholism and kind of macho culture.
Right.
And they're always seeing stuff that's really the worst of humanity.
Right.
So we need to really sort of educate the people. But also, when I talked to these police officers, I was saying, I think the drug war is a failure. And we're sitting at a time where 110 or so thousand people die last year in America from opiate and fentanyl overdoses. I mean, it's pretty clear the drug war is not working.
Right.
If you think it's about reducing drug abuse. So I think there's this struggle between the forces of life, the forces of, the ignoring death, what's going to come out of this.
Well, I think for the past 50 years and probably for the next 50 years is probably the most pivotal point in human history.
Yeah.
Because I think we have the ability to destroy ourselves.
Right.
So are we going to evolve past that where we can, because it's a big threat right now. I mean, it could easily, with everything going on in the world right now, I mean, it's not far-fetched to think it could happen tomorrow.
Right.
And so we kind of need to evolve past all that and come together. I'll do a group MDMA session and understand each other.
Well, I think that would help a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that there's, I just want to add one thing is when I turned 21, I inherited some money, not a great amount, but enough to build a house. So my plan was to build this house and then build a sailboat. A friend of mine was a world-class sailor and a sailboat builder, and then I was going to sail around the world. I made fundamental mistakes building this house, meaning that it cost way more than I thought. I ran out of money. I built the most expensive house in the neighborhood, which is not good for your value.
Right.
And so I never got around to the boat. But the idea of sort of making your own way around the world through the oceans has always appealed to me.
It's not too late.
I still have a bunch of work to do, both making a landing, medicalization, and then the globalization for humanitarian projects.
Sure.
But I read a book called Island by Aldous Huxley that... it was the last book that he wrote. He wrote Doors of Perception. That's where it was about his mescaline experience. The group The Doors got their name from this book, The Doors of Perception.
Oh, okay.
And he was a big advocate of psychedelics. He actually died in 1963. And as he was dying, he asked his wife, Laura, to give him LSD. So he died under the influence of LSD as a way of facilitating this letting go.
Wow.
And she wrote this beautiful book, This Timeless Moment. But Aldous's book, Island, was about this island utopia. And they'd woven psychedelics throughout it. And they would have initiation experiences for people at puberty.
Okay.
Psychedelics.
Right, okay.
And many cultures do that.
Sure, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so...
But they do a lot worse than that at puberty.
Yeah.
I mean, not that that's bad. I'm just saying they do a lot of things.
Well, they do some things that are worse.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
This, one of the therapists that we work with is the... activist against the female circumcision.
Yeah.
They call it FGM, female genital mutilation.
Yeah.
And it's terrible. People die. And it's one of the biggest causes of death for young women from this unsterilized. It's just, yeah, so people do all horrible things. But the book about Ireland had this beautiful society that's woven in with meditation, with mindfulness, with psychedelics, with love of nature. But in the end, it gets destroyed by the oil companies.
Yeah.
So the theory for me is that for those people that want to go off on their own and try to live their perfect lives, you know, that it's hard in this current era to escape from out from under nuclear war or global warming. I mean, even sailing now, the storms are worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so I think I would just sort of ask people to kind of have a foot in both worlds.
Right.
You know, try to help it become a better world collectively while people, and I think people need this kind of regenerating time on their own in nature. Sailing is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
But to the extent that you can get strength from that, so then, you know, contribute back to the struggles. Will the collective survive or not?
Yeah. Well, that's it. Who knows? But how can people get more information about MAPS? How can they get more information about you?
Yeah. Well, MAPS.org.
Okay.
There's all sorts of information there. I gave a TED Talk, so if people wanted to.
All right. Well, I'll link to that in the video there.
Okay. I also gave a story. It was called the My Origin Story. Tatao was this group, and so that's up on our website also. I think that's important. Why I did this for my whole life, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was 18, so this is 38th anniversary of MAPS tomorrow.
Oh wow!
So that's why we're here.
Oh, is that the event tomorrow? Okay, yeah. We'd like to come to that.
So the eclipse happens to be our 38th anniversary.
All right, okay.
So we figure, okay, universe is celebrating our anniversary.
Perfect.
And so that's why we had a whole series of psychedelic talks over the last couple days.
Yeah, that's great.
35,000 people here to celebrate the eclipse. We have Zendo, which is something that we started. It's psychedelic peer support and harm reduction. So people here
heard of that somewhere.
We do it at Burning Man a lot.
Okay.
So how do we build a post-prohibition world?
Right.
People are going to do psychedelics, and a lot of them are not going to be prepared for what happens.
Right, yeah.
So there are problems from keeping drugs illegal. There are also problems when they're made legal.
Exactly.
But at least when they're legal, you can address the problems.
Right.
And so what we've done at certain festivals and here is we have hundreds of volunteers, therapists, psychiatrists, different people that volunteer to support in 24-hour, 24/7, a facility for people with difficult trips.
Right.
They did it for a party, it turns difficult, and then they can get help.
Right.
So we have that here.
Oh, cool.
This festival, and I went there last night around 1:30 in the morning. It was filled. It was filled.
Wow.
With all the beds were filled with somebody having to process
experience. Wow.
So we brought sort of all the parts of MAPS, the scientific stories, the psychedelic peer support harm reduction, and then the celebration of our anniversary tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
And people from our pharma company and from the nonprofit are all here. And so it's been a great opportunity to do this podcast.
Hey, thanks. Well, congratulations, man. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And, hey, Rick, thank you so much for letting me talk with you. And I'm looking forward to seeing that tomorrow.
Yeah. I will add one other thing, which is that in June of 2023, we had the world's largest psychedelic conference ever.
Okay.
And it was in Denver. And we had 12,400 people come to this conference at the Denver Convention Center. But we're planning another one June 19th to 25th.
This year?
In 2025.
Oh, 25. Okay.
2025. So we're anticipating likely MDMA approval in August.
Okay.
Prescription use. It'll be on the market in the beginning of 2025. So I think it'll be like a new world.
Right.
This will be the first psychedelic-assisted therapy made into a medicine.
That's cool.
There's already over 2,000 ketamine clinics around America,
right.
The good ones. I'll just refer to people if you go to a ketamine clinic, do not go to the ones that give you ketamine without therapy.
Right.
Those are the ones that the words yields don't last as long, and therefore you need more ketamine.
Right.
Therefore you buy ketamine. More. And that's what the pharma company wants.
Yeah, of course.
But if you go to a ketamine clinic that has therapy with it, that teaches you to integrate it. You end up having more durable outcomes, and it can be fewer amounts of ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
So We're hoping for 20,000 people.
Oh, wow. So where is this now?
Yeah, this is going to be in Denver.
Okay.
The Denver Convention Center. And so we have 300 speakers and also.
Oh, cool.
So if people really want to learn more,
bang,
they can come to this.
Psychedelic is that on, you go to maps and find?
Yeah, okay. Maps.org.
Maps.org.
There'll be information about that. And I also think people have had a lot of information about drugs, but a lot of it is misinformation.
A lot of it.
And so I just encourage people, there's so many different ways to do research, but the one thing that I guess I should emphasize now is that this idea that MDMA hurts your brain and hurts your serotonin system and causes neurotoxicity, and Oprah had a show, that it caused holes in your brain.
Right.
So right now, in the final negotiations with FDA about whether they make MDMA do medicine, we're not even discussing neurotoxicity.
Oh, good.
It's so clear.
They're showing that it
has no effect in the amounts of MDMA. We only give MDMA three times.
Right.
And so...
What kind of dosage are you doing when you do that?
We do the first MDMA experience, the first of three, is 80 milligrams.
Okay.
And then what we do is we give, around 2 hours later, half the initial amount.
Okay.
And so the purpose of that is to extend the plateau.
Right.
So it's very people have spent their lives sometimes trying to run away from different traumas. When they're finally ready to work on it, we feel that the longer they're in this MDMA state, the better.
Yeah.
So the first is 80, followed by 40, and it's an eight-hour session. The second one... we have an option for people to go up to 120 milligrams, followed 2 hours later by 60. And the third session also could be the 80-40 or the 120-60. Okay. But around 90% go up to the 120 or 60, and around 90% continue.
Because the 80-40, that's not a... it's enough to have a good experience, but...
Yeah, so again, as I described, we're trying to build a therapeutic alliance.
Sure.
And so we want people to... learn over time. So we have found that this sort of lower dose at the beginning is helpful for people. They can still do a lot of really good work,
But they're not,
prepares them. Then they feel like they understand how to maneuver in this psychedelic state, and then they're comfortable going to a higher dose.
Well, I think most people that have some kind of bad trip or something like that, it is with paranoia or this mindset and setting, right? Yeah. And so if they've never experienced that before, they're a little nervous about it, they could maybe... But it's, like we kind of said, like the difference between like LSD and psilocybin versus MDMA is like, you know, you're not dissociative, right? So you're not... Yeah. You get a lot less anxiety. You basically get no anxiety from it.
Well, there are so many millions of people taking ecstasy every week.
Yeah.
And the amount of problems that we hear is not very many.
Right.
So very few, actually. And it's even more safer and controlled in a...
Well, with a clinical setting. When you have a doctor right there or a therapist, taking care of you.
Yeah. So I think that if I were to be going off with my wife or something on a sailboat for a while, and if I were, wanting to fully appreciate the majesty of the universe...
Yes.
I would bring some psychedelics.
Yeah, there you go.
Different kinds.
I hear you. Why don't you come sail with us sometime? A couple times a year, we have these flotillas. Plus, then we're getting a new boat this summer, and you're always welcome to come along and sail with us. So,
okay, I'd look forward to that.
Yeah.
Because one thing that I've never done is really take a boat across the Atlantic.
Well, we're planning to do that. It might interfere with your Denver conference, but we're planning to do that. No, we're going to do that. Spring, so that'd be like April or May of 25.
Okay, good, because our conference will be in June.
Yeah. So that's what we're planning to do, is we're crossed. So I get my new boat delivered to the East Coast by the end of the summer, and we're going to go down to the Caribbean November 1st, down the islands, and then around March or April, we'll sail across the Atlantic to the Med.
Wow. So I should talk about Michael Midover and Annie Midover. So Michael's a psychiatrist. He is our, and Annie were the... treated the most people in phase two. They helped write the treatment manual.
Mm-hmm.
They have two daughters. And when their daughters were about 6 and 8, something like that, they took 5 years off and sailed around the world and lived on a sailboat with their kids, did homeschooling, and they educated them. And they just said it was incredible bonding for their family. And now they're super tight.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Michael and Annie were off on a sailboat as part of his sort of transition also, because he was an emergency room physician and saw a lot of people coming back for injuries and realized psychological factors, and then he switched to become a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I have a lot of appreciation for what he was able to do with his family. And it kind of makes you... God, wish I would have done that with my own kids, to be like that on a boat.
It's hard. I've met a lot of families do that. When you have younger children, like under, when they're not a teenager yet,
yeah,
it's great. Once they get to be a teenager, they're getting interested in boys and girls, and they want, yeah, you know, they're kind of like, hey, you know, but
right,
but until that point, it's great having them aboard for everything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And then I guess you just have to teach them to swim.
Well, yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Don't want them falling off of the water. So.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks. All right, well, Rick, thank you so much for letting me talk to you, and I look forward to all you're doing, and congratulations, man. That's a great success you've had.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
All right.